Good afternoon and welcome to this edition of Officer Radio here on Officer.com. I'm Frank Borelli, your host, and with us today again, and thank you for returning, is Lieutenant Jason Stoddard. We're going to talk today about patrol rifles. As I record this earlier today, I wrote a blog about patrol rifles and some of the challenges we used to have in the past, even simply getting them, even though we knew we needed them. Even though our chiefs and our sheriffs knew we needed them, there seemed to be hurdles to overcome and challenges to address. So that's what the good lieutenant and I are going to talk about. Thank you for joining us today, LT.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Always a pleasure, sir. You're just enough like me that there's not too much filter between your brain and your mouth, and that makes it educational yet entertaining.
I'm trying to learn that.
Well, you know, I never made it past lieutenant because I spent too many years telling people who outranked me how stupid they were. I've tried to learn better. I still have issues with it at times, but I think you've perfected the skill a little bit better than I have. That said, it's something we're both going to have to pay attention to in this call because there is a lot of potential here simply to call some people stupid. Talking about patrol rifles, look back prior to Columbine, prior to 1999 and the active shooter craze, if you want to call it that. How common were they in the patrol cars in your experience?
I didn't hardly find them at all. I think the first time that they were brought up was probably as a national topic was probably in 1997. During the North Hollywood shootout, the unfortunate part about it is I have a memo from 1964, I believe, that was written by the head SWAT member or head SWAT team leader of Los Angeles' police department, requesting that officers have M1s and M14s in their police cars, and it kind of sat on the back shelf. And then when 1997 happened in L.A. The subject got brought up.
You know, I feel kind of stupid for a moment because I didn't think L.A. or anybody else out west or anybody in the country even started developing SWAT teams until after 66. I thought Charles Whitman in the Texas Tower, one of the earliest documented active shooters of recent history anyway, was one of the causes of the development of SWAT. You've got a memo from a SWAT team member from 64?
I may be off on the date. I don't have it in front of me, but I know it was in that general time frame of the mid to late 1960s.
And we're still talking about almost half a century ago when you look at it. I mean, it's almost 50 years ago.
Absolutely.
And we've known a long time. Okay, so 97, North Hollywood. We all watched that on television. Heavily armored, tranquilized, if you will, perpetrators with automatic, illegally modified, as I understand it, automatic weapons, outgunning the police officers who were restricted to shotguns and handguns, typically in 9mm, some 45s. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And you would think we would learn our lesson, but 99 Columbine comes around. Not that the Harrison Kleibold had these heavy-duty weapons, but we came to the reality that our handguns are simply not sufficient to address targets at the length of some hallways in these high schools. I mean, in your jurisdiction, offhand, do you know or can you guesstimate what the longest main hallway you might have to take a shot down is?
We have one high school in our county that I believe the main hallway in it runs almost a quarter of a mile. It's a brand new high school that they just built, and it is a huge endeavor to do anything active shooter related inside of that school.
And I don't think people realize how many square acres we're talking about under a roof when you start looking at the multiple floors. If I remember, at Columbine, it was like 2.5 square acres inside the school. And I may be lowballing that number. When you start trying to move through it, to move to the sound of the shots. I mean, so for active shooter protocols today, typically we still are responding to the scene, forming a hasty team, moving the sound of the shots, neutralizing the shooter. And when I say neutralize a shooter, and I said this yesterday on a webinar for Security Info Watch, what I mean is put so many holes in him he ceases to function. I'm quite happy about the fact that I've never been told in any active shooter class that my first goal is to arrest the shooter. My first goal is to neutralize the shooter. And I'm quite delighted about that. If you hunt our children, we should hunt you. It's just how I feel about it. That's only the opinion of Frank Borelli, not Officer.com, Cygnus Business Media, or any other related affiliates. Now that I got the legal crap out of the way. Long shots down hallways. You're talking about a quarter mile. I know even my son's middle school, we had a hallway that was well over 140, 150 yards. Not something we can do with a handgun.
No, absolutely not.
So,
not something that you can do with a rifle without being properly trained for it.
But let's for a second differentiate this. When I went through active shooter class, active shooter instructor school, and I remember, I went here in Southern Maryland. The primary instructor is now a gentleman who's in charge just south of you. You know who I'm talking about. And some of the SWAT guys over there were the instructors, one that I went to the academy with. And I remember this very clearly. The lead instructor said, everybody who's got a rifle in your patrol car, raise your hand. And about two-thirds of the class put up their hand, and they were absolutely delighted to be able to put up their hand because they felt they belonged to a progressive enough agency that they could actually have a long gun. And then another instructor said, well, hold a minute. How many of you with your hands up actually have rifles in true rifle calibers, .223, .308, 7mm, or something, not, you know, 9mm, 40, 45, not handgun calibers? And about two-thirds of those people had to put their hand down. So we ended up, out of a class of 30, with maybe 7 or 8 guys that actually had patrol rifles in .223 or 5.56 millimeter, .308, or some other significant rifle caliber. So in 99, after Columbine, when the big push for quote-unquote rifles came, patrol rifles, how many agencies do you think really went to actual rifles versus an agency I know of just north of you that approved a handgun caliber long gun?
I think that back in the early 2000s, that there was a push to get anything out there that had a little bit longer barrel length, and a lot of departments, due to budget reasons, due to training reasons, or whatever reason they could come up with, did initially authorize the agency that I work for in our policy, you're still authorized to carry a rifle that's a handgun caliber. I think as things have progressed, if we've seen the threat grow and continue to grow, that most of people are going away from those handgun caliber rifles. I think most people have been able to prove to the powers that be in their departments that if you're going to put us with a rifle that's got a 14, 16, 18-inch barrel on it, what good does it do to have a pistol caliber in that's not defeating the body armor, that you can't use as effectively as you can a rifle caliber rifle?
Right.
I think as time has progressed, we're starting to see that those decrease. I think that with the opening of what I know as DRMO through the United States military, that was recently closed because of some accounting issues, and hopefully will be open very soon again, that many agencies were able to pick up M16A1s that were Vietnam vintage guns that were still good, that still came in the original packages that they got for free.
Right.
And I hope that in the near future we'll see the federal government open that back up to local police departments to get the equipment that they need that's out there that's a very little expense to them. It was a great resource while it was open. It's now been closed. Hopefully we'll see it reopen again very soon.
For those that aren't aware of it, DRMO is the Defense Reutilization Management Office, and they take surplus property from the federal government, specifically from the Department of Defense, and they offer it down to the states and counties to equip law enforcement, and there's no charge. So it's tax dollars that were spent on equipment that never got used or is still in serviceable condition, effectively being recycled out of the military and into law enforcement. And that kind of brings us to another topic. A lot of people were upset. A lot of the public were upset. Some chiefs and sheriffs folded to the pressure. Council members get upset. People get so involved in an anti-gun or a gun control issue where patrol rifles for law enforcement is concerned that there was this big thing about, number one, militarizing the police, and number two, equipping our police officers for offensive, aggressive, militaristic action, you know, these black rifles, the assault weapons, all these terms that get thrown out. How do you feel about this? I'll make it a very specific question. What's your outlook on police administrators that limit their officers to weapons that aren't quite as military looking?
I think that there definitely has been that in the past. There are some places in the United States that we still have that issue. I think we're getting better. I was looking at officer.com's website, and on the front of the website, it's got a picture of a officer in Minnesota carrying an AR that just responded to the active shooter yesterday that they had up there. I think we're starting to see more police officers in the media. We're starting to see more pictures of officers in the media, videos and things like that of officers that are utilizing these weapons appropriately. And I think the stigma is starting to go away. The forethinking chiefs, the progressive chiefs that are out there that really didn't care what the more liberal portions of society said about overarming the police and things like that. I think with all the media that we're starting to see, I think a lot of that perception is going away. North Hollywood did a great deal of that to say, look at how outgunned we are. And every time we have one of these incidents, I think it's becoming more and more general knowledge, and it's becoming less and less arguable that we are outgunned on the street. The number one bullet that's killing police officers from rifles in the United States is a 7.62x39, usually fired out of an AK-47. We have nothing without the patrol rifle to compete with that. There's many arguments that are made as far as what calibers we should be carrying. Obviously, the 5.56 or the 223 being the predominant weapon that's utilized just simply because of the availability of them. However, with the new technology in ballistics, with the new technology and weapons that are out there, there are other calibers that we probably need to be looking at, things like the 6.8, even to step up and go with the 7.62x39. With the ballistic technology that's out there now, the overpenetration issues that everybody argued about, well, we can't use this because it'll overpenetrate the target. We may lose a round outside the house. I think those things are becoming less and less of an argument as technology increases.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I was just in an event up in Montana a couple weeks ago, and Hornady they were demonstrating some .223 ammo that didn't penetrate more than 13 inches of ballistic gelatin. So over-penetration definitely wasn't a problem. Let me ask you this. I mean, we've overcome this stigma a lot, and we have many more ARs, .223, 5.56 weapons in the trunks of patrol cars. Do you think we're ever going to see a wider acceptance? I mean, the bad guys are using AKs, however they're coming by them. Do you think we're going to see a wider acceptance of the AK as a law enforcement weapon, or do you think it still has that communist stigma attached to it because it came out of the Soviet bloc?
I think there's still a stigma attached to it. They say, everybody that I've talked to that has a lot of knowledge about these guns, they're one of the most reliable weapons platforms that's out there. Now we start talking about seeing pictures in the media of officers carrying AK-47s. I'm not sure the general public's prepared for that at this point. Is there other platforms out there that carries a 7.62? I believe SCAR puts out, FN Herschel puts out their SCAR that has an interchangeable barrel with the 7.62, or you can purchase it in a 7.62. And I think it becomes an issue of, do you want your guys with an AK-47, or can we put them with a SCAR or some other type of weapons platform, an AR-10, that the general public just can't tell what it is.
I think that's the problem. We're still making decisions based on public perception and not on equipping our officers with that which they need to defeat the potential bad guys. And I'll take this a step further. We've had a conversation so far now, 13 and a half minutes into this conversation, God bless technology. We've been talking about active shooter. We've been talking about North Hollywood bank robber. Let's talk about Mumbai. Let's talk about a multi-vector terrorist attack that our police officers are going to be on the front lines and having to fight against. Now, does it really matter whether the appearance of the rifle in their hand is publicly offensive, or should we be focusing on the fact that they need to be properly equipped to take out terrorists?
Well, I think we need to be looking at the equipment, at the equipment standpoint. However, we both know, we've both been doing this job a long time, that when it comes to the upper levels of the police department, there are some decisions that are made based off of that. And now we have a way to go around it. It's not, the platform is not just an AK-47. There are other platforms that we can utilize. There's always going to be the public argument of, we don't like the way that looks. And everything that we do, it's no different than when the taser first hit People didn't like the taser because everybody blamed it on all these deaths that were happening. Scientific studies have basically thrown all of those out the window, and now it's become more of an accepted thing, and we see that all throughout what we do and the equipment that we have. I think that it's going to take some progressive chiefs to step out there and to say, my guys are going to be wearing the things that they need to fight every threat that they face out there. And depending on where they're at, the location in the United States, that may or may not go over well. I'm a strong proponent that within the next 15 years, we're probably going to see a majority of police departments go away from the traditional Class A uniform that most of us wear on the street and go to more of a BDU-style uniform that is more functional. I believe that progressive chiefs are looking for ways to take things off of officers' belts and put them more on their chests. I think we're going to see the same thing come down.
Hey, LT, let me interrupt you for a second for two things. One, we're getting some static from your line. I don't know if you're on a cordless, you moved too far away from your base station or whatever. We're getting some static. Two, I like the direction you're going. A friend of mine once said that movies gave us the future, and his big thing was RoboCop when it came out way back when. Body armor was external. Every cop was wearing a helmet. We were driving mid-sized sedans. Well, we got two of them. A lot of people are wearing external body armor now, even though it doesn't look quote-unquote tactical. And most of us don't have full-size sedan. I mean, there's still a lot of Crown Vics in our area, but the Charger I don't consider a full-size sedan. A lot of people were using Tauruses. Ford's new Interceptor I consider mid-size. I think he was right to some extent. Now, having interrupted you, I'll apologize. But continue on with the Chiefs. You're talking about them being a little bit more progressive, but we needed some more of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we're stuck with in law enforcement is the fact that many of our upper echelon of the chiefs in our department all came out of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And they know policing is one way. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, we have to learn to be progressive. I read an essay a while ago that was written that basically said that American law enforcement wouldn't become an actual profession until 2050. When we compare ourselves to what goes on in Europe, and there's all kinds of arguments about what they're doing over there versus what we do over here, but to simply drive a car in some countries as a police officer, it's 6 months worth of training. In some countries, they go through a 6 month of police academy, go out on the street for 6 months, and then return back to the police academy for another 6 months before they become a full-fledged police officer.
Holy cow!
When we look at what we're doing here in the United States, it's butts in seats for many departments. Get a guy, train him through the academy, depending on where you're at. I think we're fairly lucky that our police academies on the East Coast, for the most part, are 6 months long.
Yep.
However, out of that 6 months, you spend five months of it learning how not to get sued and to do the paperwork, and a month of it of learning what could save your life in the form of officer safety skills, in the form of on the shooting range, and on the form of in your vehicles.
Right.
And it's somewhat backwards, but we are forced to put people out on the street. Our FTO program in the department that I work in is 14 weeks long. What's the additional follow-up? You talk to these, I recently sat through a class and they talk about how the average police officer that's killed in the United States has 11 years on. Well, what is that saying about the officers that have 3 years on that on average they're not the ones that are passing away in the line of duty because of the training is fresh in their head still.
So, but what do we do about that? I mean, and we're getting off the topic of patrol rifles, but it, excellent point. But what do we do about that? Send somebody back to the academy every 3 years or every 2 years? I mean, we have, in my opinion, severely lacking in service requirements. When your police officer has to go to school for 2 days a year and go to the range once, and maybe if we're lucky, go to the driving course once, we're just not cutting it. We're not maintaining skills. And then complacency sets in when you reach anywhere close to the halfway point. When you start combining a lack of maintenance with an increase in complacency, it's a formula for fatalities.
Absolutely. And I think it relates right to the patrol rifles and the fact that we have to become progressive in everything that we're doing. And part of that relates to the continued training, the required training. We have grown to accept mediocrity in our ranks, and we've had that conversation in the past.
Yep.
And we can't continue. And as we relate this back to the patrol rifle, it goes along the same lines. I can remember a department that I did some training for that their initial qualification score for a patrol rifle of a course that is was only out to 100 yards and you only fired maybe 5 rounds from 100 yards. The original policy said that you had to shoot at least a 90 to carry the patrol rifle and pass the class.
Okay.
By the time they got done with their first class, over 3/4 of the officers that were there did not shoot above a 90. Instead of retraining them, they dropped the percentage down to 85.
Okay.
And that's scary.
Yeah.
Because it's just simply a stroke of the pen, and we accepted the mediocrity.
And at 100 yards with a rifle, shooting 90% ought to be relatively easy.
Exactly. And those are the things that we have to get away from. We can no longer accept that mediocrity. We have standards. We want to make those standards not unattainable, but we don't want to bend the standards either, just with a simple rewrite when a majority of our people don't pass. And as it relates to going back to the equipment that we carry, we can't let the media and the people who just don't like the police, no matter what we do, we can't let them tell us what we should and shouldn't have. But at the same time, there is a fine line that we have to walk in order to have the equipment that we need and still keep our customers, for lack of a better word, happy with the response that we have. And unfortunately, we have been, unfortunately as well, it's been since September 11th since we've had a major full-scale terrorist attack in the United States, and it's been forgotten about. When you talk about what happened in Mumbai, it was a perfect example of what could happen in any major metropolitan city in this country. And it was discussed for a very short period of time overall in law enforcement in general, and then forgotten about.
Well, and it's a shame, but what, I mean, neither one of us wants to have another educational experience where we're forced to evolve, but typically in law enforcement, we're reactive and we don't evolve our tactics until something forces us to. We've seen some mild evolution in active shooter response since the growth of the movement after Columbine. Typical protocols were developed, said form a hasty four-man team, diamond-shaped formation, make entry, use these tactics, move to the sound of shots, neutralize the shooter, unless something converts to a barricaded gunman situation, and then, you know, the different tactics apply. We've evolved somewhat. You get some people out there teaching two-man teams. You've got some people teaching by necessity single-man entries, because in some places you just can't get a second guy in any kind of decent time frame, much less four. But how do we evolve police work without more loss of life? We're entirely reactive. How can we be proactive about this? What's it going to take?
Well, we have to continue to educate ourselves to what's going on, not only in the entire country, but in the world. You know, everything that happens overseas eventually will come here. One prime example would be how many departments in this country outside of the major federal place that we work that has every federal installation and every federal police department that we have, it's headquartered here. Outside of Washington, D.C., how many other areas have protocols for suicide bombers or for homicide bombers?
Oh, I don't think anybody. I think it probably took an act of God for the IACP to finally say headshots might be acceptable given the circumstances on an identified suicide bomber.
Oh, precisely.
You and I prefer to call them homicide bombers. For our listeners, it's because their primary purpose is to kill, not themselves, but other people. If all you want to do is kill yourself, you're a suicide bomber, but you don't take other people with you. If you detonate a bomb strapped to your body with the intention of killing other people, you're committing homicide. You're just sacrificing yourself in the process, which we're seeing largely as part of a jihad internationally. Thankfully, in this country, we haven't seen it yet.
But without seeing it, we haven't evolved. And what's wrong with looking at that and being proactive and saying, you know what, this could happen in my jurisdiction, and it's something that we need to look at. And I know we have the day-to-day operations of everything else that's going on in our department, but most big, larger police departments have some type of a planning section.
Right.
And that planning section should be looking, they should be looking at these things that are happening and trying to come up with training protocols and policy and procedure that deal with them.
And then it would trickle down from the bigger agencies to the smaller agencies.
Absolutely. And most of the time, and I hate to say this, but most of the time it travels from west to east in the United States. For the most part, not on everything, but it does.
I think we clash in the middle someplace, and I guess that's a different conversation to have as protocols develop, because even the SWAT teams develop different tactics, and I think it was based on the personalities of the people in the first SWAT teams, but we'll leave that alone because we're coming up on our time limit.
I think as we continue to progress, some of the things that the lessons learned that we're seeing in Afghanistan and in Iraq that are coming back from our soldiers, from our National Guard troops, from the reserve troops, from guys that fought over there, and then they become police officers here after their enlistments are up. We cannot discount that experience, and we need to take that experience and we need to move forward with it. And I think many times, the old adage in police work of once you graduate the academy, your FTO tells you, well, forget everything you learned in the academy. Now you're going to learn the way we do it on the street. Well, if we continue to do that with those things, we're never going to progress. And as it relates to the patrol rifle conversation, the equipment conversation, we have to take that knowledge, those lessons learned that these guys are learning every day, that we're paying for by the blood of our young men and women that are so courageous to go over there. We have to take that knowledge and we have to bring it back here. There's all kinds of equipment. I had an agency recently call me and say, hey, we're looking at going to these patrol rifles. We want to put these accessories on it. What can you tell me about these accessories? The first question that I asked them was, have you called any of the units that have been overseas and found out what worked for them and what hasn't worked for them? Because there's all kinds of Gucci gear out there that's cool in a magazine, but when you put it in the street, it doesn't last.
I wish you could see the big smile on my face. I love that term, Gucci gear. Spandex camouflage just is not functional. LT, we're at the end of our time here, man. I appreciate you being on the show as always. You make some excellent points, and hopefully the people listening, I encourage you folks listening, take this podcast, copy it over to a jump drive, and go hand it to whoever it is that selects equipment for your agency and say, hey, just listen, there's a good argument for patrol rifles. Do that if your agency still got you restricted to handgun caliber rifles, or if you're still restricted to shotguns, or, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about this, if when they gave you a patrol rifle, they took your shotgun away from you. That's a whole nother conversation. Absolutely makes positive, no sense at all. LT, thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Frank. I appreciate the invite.
Stay safe on the street. I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.